At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. You know, sometimes, most times, maybe, the economy's just not about the data. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Friday today. This one is the first day of December, if you can believe that. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Yes, we will talk about the economic data of the 5 days gone by because, you know, you should. We will also, though, talk about the mood abroad in this economy. And we're going to do it with Gina Smilek. She's at the New York Times. Neil Richardson is at ADP. Hey, you two.
Hey, Kai.
Neil, let me start with you and the aforementioned data. Gross domestic product, 5.2% in the third quarter. We got that revision this week. Inflation, the PCE. 3% year on year, basically flat month to month. Is this what a soft landing looks like?
Not yet, Kai.
Oh, you're killing me. You're killing me.
No, because the destination is 2% target and we're not there yet. And there's some sense by the Federal Reserve that it's going to be harder to get from 3.5% to 2% inflation than it was to even fall from the peak of 9% last year down to like 6%. That last mile is often the hardest mile. And if you look at the dynamics of the economy right now, we can go into that a little later with Gina, is that, you know, this is a inflation rate that is smoldering a little bit. There could be another log put on this hot fireplace that causes it to roar back. And those logs look like housing, oil prices, or even wages. So you can't say yet that mission has been accomplished because 2% hasn't been reached and it hasn't been sustained.
All right, Gina, I got to go back to Neela for one more thing, and then we're going to come to you about the feelings of this economy. But Neela, can we at least say like we're in the approach phase of a soft landing? I mean, it's been out there for so long. The numbers do look good, and I understand that that last percent or 1.2 percentage points is going to be the toughest. But we're on the right glide slope, right? If I could just torture that aviation analogy one more time.
Absolutely. We might have to put to bed the aviation.
Yeah, no, I know. I'm sorry.
Analogy.
We're done with it now. I promise.
What I usually say is that you're waiting on the tarmac to be released out of the gate.
Okay.
We've landed somewhere, but we're not exactly to the gate yet because we haven't reached 2%.
All right.
So, yeah, we can figure out how we're getting it, but there's not a lot of turbulence into this glide path. If you look at the unemployment rate, if you look at third quarter GDP, if you look at any kind of indicator of layoffs in the economy, it looks like it's not a turbulent landing. And that is something that we can be really confident about, at least right now with the current data.
Turbulent landings are very, very bad. All right. So, Gina, with the acknowledgement that you were on, shall we say another podcast? Fine. It was The Daily. Fine. Whatever. Talking about the vibe in this economy and with a hat tip to Kyle O'Scanlan, I do want to get some sense from you about the disconnect between how people are feeling about this economy, which is generally speaking not great, and the actual economic data, which is objectively kind of good.
Yeah, yeah, there's a huge disconnect between what people tell us they feel, both in sort of the traditional surveys that we use to measure confidence, and also in like the political polling. People feel pretty crappy about the economy. And all of the data that we usually kind of look at to think right. about how people should feel about the economy, you know, unemployment's below 4%, inflation's high, but it's coming down. Like you would think people would be feeling a little bit better right now. We're just not seeing that materialize. And so we've been digging into that a lot. And, you know, you hear a couple of things. One is price levels, yep. right? Yep. Prices are up a lot compared to where they were in like late 2019. And people remember what prices looked like in late 2019. We had a lot of inflation over a short period of time. And even though that inflation has really faded, that means that we've been left with much higher prices than we previously had. So I think that's part of it. I think part of it's things like housing affordability, some of these longer run issues that are very difficult to tackle. You know, we've seen a big jump in home prices recently, and I think it feels out of reach for a lot of millennials and Gen Zers to sort of mm-hmm. afford houses. Mm-hmm. So things like that do seem to be a big part of the malaise. But I think this is going to be a really interesting story to watch going forward.
Say more about interesting, because we don't want interesting in this economy. We want good and people feeling nice about things.
Yeah, we would like nice, but interesting is at least more more useful for reporters like me. but no, I think the truth of the matter here is that this is going to be really fascinating to watch for this political cycle, because what we do see is that the Biden administration seems to be taking some blame for a lot of these sort of long running or serious issues that people feel bad about in the economy. And whether that sort of malaise continues, whether people continue to feel bad, could be an important determinant of how people vote. You know, people don't always vote on economic issues, but sometimes they do. And so if sort of the status quo persists, that could be a real problem for this administration come the next election and potentially a boon to the Republicans.
Yeah. Okay. So, Neela, we had Austin Goolsbee on the program on Tuesday, Wednesday. I forget. Frankly, they all run together. And I had asked him how worried he is about the Fed overshooting, staying too tight, keeping interest rates too high for too long. And here's part of what he said.
Anybody who cooks a turkey knows that you got to pull it out of the oven before it's to the point where you want it to be, because it's going to have residual heat.
So first of all, classic Austin Goolsbee, Neela, but also he's not wrong, right, that there is a chance that the Fed keeping rates high or where they are for longer dries out the turkey.
I love these analogies tonight, actually, because there's another, I cooked a turkey and I've had this embarrassing thing happen where the turkey looks dead and then you cut it open and it's raw at the bone. Yeah. Let's make sure that doesn't happen with inflation as well, that we think it looks done, but it's actually not. So yes, there is a tendency to overshoot or undershoot, but what's different this time, and always be aware when an economist says that, but what's different this time is the labor market. The labor market has been somewhat resilient to all of these interest rate hikes. And just to go back to the point about how people are feeling, the vibe in the economy, there's a real generational divide that was touched upon between how millennials are feeling and how people who are not looking for housing and are not thinking about student loan payments I think are doing. And so all of this is making the economy really complicated to pinpoint, and that makes the Fed's job even harder.
So, Gina, let me end with this. We've got a minute and a half, whatever. If I'm a casual news consumer, you know, paying my mortgage and trying to send a kid through college and, you know, doing my job, whatever, and I see the data about the economy, and I know what my own life is like. What's my takeaway from the economy now, I guess, is my question.
Yeah. So I think, again, interesting to watch this disconnect. It seems like the takeaway, as people tell us, is relatively negative. But I think there's some reason to hope that that could improve in the months ahead. And one of those reasons is we've seen sentiment get a little bit better as inflation has faded. And so as that continues, as people get used to the fact that inflation's not, at least prices aren't going up as much anymore, I think people could start to feel a little bit better, especially to the extent that their wages are catching up. And then I think the other thing that's important is interest rates seem to be close to, probably at their highest rate, and may come down next year. And so I think that may make people feel a little bit better about this economy. So I think there are some reasons to hope. I think there are also some reasons for caution.
Right, right. Sorry, Neela, super quick, 30 more seconds, and I'm going to have to squeeze something out of the rest of the show. How worried are you? What is your concern level over consumers and them pulling back a little bit?
You know, I was just thinking that, so I'm glad you asked. What people feel and what they do are sometimes not the same.
Yeah.
And what we've seen with consumers are their spending. So they may feel bad about it, but they're still showing up at restaurants, concerts, movies, and buying things. And as long as they continue to do that, and I think they will if we still see unemployment rate below 4% and this very healthy labor market, then if the consumer still spends, the economy will likely still grow. And that's good news.
All right. Now we really got to go. It's Neela Richardson at ADP and Gina Smolik, The New York Times on this Friday. Thanks, you two.
Thanks, Scott.
Wall Street to end this week, up for the day, up for the 5 days. We will have the details when we do the numbers. We are very much in the thick of the holiday shopping season on this first day of December. A lot of that shopping, as you know, is happening online. And with online shopping often comes an expectation of free returns. There is a decent chance now, though, that if you want to send an item back, the place you bought it from might just say, yeah, you know, keep it. As Reuters reported this week, returnless refunds or keep it return policies are now being offered by more than half of major retailers. Marketplace's Henry Epp explains why these policies make economic sense for retailers and why they might not want to tell you about them.
A couple years ago, Mark Cohen, director of retail studies at Columbia Business School, ordered a fabric steamer from Target.
I saw it online. It was exactly what I was looking for.
But when a package showed up at his apartment, it was very much not a fabric steamer.
It was a king-size comforter.
He called Target, which apologized for the mix-up, and told him to keep it, saying,
it would be overly burdensome for us to take it back.
Cohen says that's because taking stuff back is way more expensive for retailers than sending it out. Sean Burke, a partner at Clarkston Consulting, says first there are shipping costs, and then
unpacking it and reviewing it and seeing if it can be resold, and if it can be resold, going in and restocking it on their shelves.
All that work requires time, money, and staff.
And so retailers have to sit there and say, is it worth it?
Amina Ali is CEO of the returns management company Optoro. She says the answer is often no. That was especially true a couple years ago when freight costs skyrocketed, says Zach Rogers, who teaches supply chain management at Colorado State.
And now freight's cheap, but it was kind of nice to not have to deal with it.
That's why a lot of retailers have kept their keep it return policies. But these can also be abused by shoppers who resell what they supposedly want to return, says Clarkston Consulting's Sean Burke.
And so that's why you generally don't see people necessarily publicizing that they do this.
To deal with fraud, he says, online retailers use all the data they gather from us to find patterns.
Hey, this Sean Burke guy, he's done a lot of returns lately. They can start to pinpoint that maybe they shouldn't allow me to do this anymore in the future.
But in most cases, he says, shoppers are going to give away the returns they get stuck with. Or in the case of Mark Cohen and his comforter, they'll hold on to it for years.
Eventually, it's going to wind up in a Goodwill bin or a Salvation Army bin.
He just hasn't gotten around to it yet. I'm Henry Epp for Marketplace.
It's not just retail where bargains are abounding. A lot of restaurant chains have been running flashy deals of late, too. There were Applebee's $1 margaritas, dollaritas, should you have missed that. The Olive Garden has its never-ending pasta bowl, and Red Lobster has ultimate endless shrimp, which was originally $20, now $25, because the seafood chain says it helped drive its $11 million operating loss, although shrimp did in the third quarter. Marketplace's Kristen Schwab looks at the business payoffs and pitfalls of deals that can seem too good to be true.
For some people, all-you-can-eat shrimp is simply a good deal. For others, it is a contest. TikTok user UGG_Madison recently ate 108 shrimp at Red Lobster.
My waitress was so proud of me, I set a new record at my local Red Lobster. This is my greatest achievement in life.
It's worth noting she did not order the shrimp Alfredo, because filling up on pasta is an amateur move. And she only ordered water to drink. Lizzie Fryer at Technomic, a food service research and consulting company, says that's the opposite of what the restaurant wants.
A lot of these operators are willing to take a loss in one area just to get customers in the door where they're hopefully going to be spending more elsewhere on the menu.
A side of fries, a glass of wine, these add-ons add up. Unless no one orders them, and the margins on the special are shrimpy.
Obviously, there's a lot of risks to doing something like this.
Risks like people over-consuming alcohol with drink deals, or diners lingering to enjoy specials, which means fewer tips for servers. And David Portalatin, a food industry advisor at Circana, says long-running deals can shift customer expectations.
You want to avoid creating this downward price spiral to the bottom.
Remember the $5 footlong? It became so synonymous with Subway that once the chain raised prices, some customers walked, says Sean Dunlop, an analyst at Morningstar. But he says deals aren't just about revenue. They're also about creating buzz and loyalty.
The big thing is that you're investing in the future.
Dunlop says most people visit the same restaurant 4 or 5 times a year, so every extra visit counts, especially now. He says restaurants have seen a decline in customers over the last year and a half. Inflation has been rough for chains like Red Lobster and Applebee's.
They're not really exposed to the true luxury consumer that sort of continues to spend through the cycle.
Nor are these sit-down chains the typical choice for people hyper-focused on price. They might opt for fast food instead. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
If you happen to have missed something on the air, we've got a podcast you can check out if you like. Marketplace.org, of course, or the platform of your choice. Coming up.
The reason I'm doing it is because I can see what's coming.
Intuition, one might say. But first, sure, why not? Let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 294 points today, 0.8%, finished at 36,245. The NASDAQ picked up 78 points, 0.6%, 14,305. S&P 500 up 26 points, 0.6%, 45.94 there. For the week, the 5 days gone by, the Dow grew 2.4%. The NASDAQ took on 0.4%. S&P 500 climbed 0.8% today. We just heard from Kristen Schwab about the deals offered by chain restaurants. So let us see how some of those chains are doing, shall we? Dine Brands Global, which operates and franchises restaurants like Applebee's and IHOP, surged 6.3% today. Darden Restaurants, owner of Olive Garden and Longhorn Steakhouse, savored a 2.2% increase. The Cheesecake Factory, known for both large restaurants and expansive menus and large portions, sweetened 4.9% today. Bond prices went up. The yield on the 10-year T-note went down 4.21%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
My name is Lee Hawkins. I've been a journalist for over 25 years. On my new podcast, What Happened in Alabama, I get answers to some of the hardest questions about how things came to be for many Black Americans and the truth that must come before any reconciliation can happen. I investigate my family history, my upbringing in Minnesota, and my father's painful nightmares about growing up in Alabama. What Happened in Alabama is a new series confronting the cycles of trauma for myself, my family, and for many Black Americans. Listen now.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. The economic data of this Friday came in two flavors, making stuff and building stuff. From the Institute of Supply Management this morning, we got what's called the Purchasing Managers Index. It is a measure of U.S. manufacturing, and it came in flat today, which is not great because it's been in subpar territory, indicating contraction for more than a year now. New orders, employment, and inventories were all down. Elsewise, the Commerce Department told us today that construction spending was up better than 0.5% last month, up more than 10% from a year ago. What, you may rightly ask, does all of that mean, and why are you telling me? Well, that's what Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman spent his day figuring out.
High interest rates and a slowing global economy have been challenging for U.S. manufacturers. Bill Adams at Comerica Bank says there's a lot of uncertainty about what consumers will do and how much stuff businesses that sell to them will need.
Businesses are being more cautious in managing their purchases. Supply chains are functioning much better than during the pandemic, but that also means that businesses are not maintaining precautionarily high levels of inventories.
And higher interest rates make a lot of manufactured goods more expensive, from business equipment to home appliances to cars and trucks, says Beth Ann Bovino at U.S. Bank.
Auto manufacturing hit by labor strikes, but also weakness from higher borrowing costs as pent-up demand starts to be exhausted.
Meanwhile, over in the construction aisle of the economy, it's a whole different story.
Fantastic.
That's how Tony Leibert describes the business environment right now. He's a 60-year-old construction electrician in Madison, Wisconsin.
We're very healthy. The work outlook up here looks great for the next several years.
His union's apprenticeship program is filling up, and there's lots of work building hospitals, nursing homes, retirement communities. That squares with the story of strong housing demand nationwide, says Danishka Nanayakara at the National Association of Home Builders.
The housing market is poised for gains for 2024. There's a large amount of multifamily units under construction right now, over 1 million units.
Also, a lot of factories, accounting for nearly half the growth in construction spending this year, says Bill Adams.
So even though manufacturers are pretty cautious about the outlook for the next couple of months, they are investing in production capacity for the next 10 and 20 and 30 years.
A lot of that's thanks to the CHIPS Act and federal spending on electric vehicle technology and infrastructure. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
While the notables and dignitaries are doing their thing at the big UN climate conference in Dubai, the actual doing of fighting climate change is happening almost everywhere else. We are trying to do two things here: cut emissions from fossil fuels and get carbon out of the atmosphere, sequestering it, someplace is the technical term. Some of those places where carbon might be sequestered could be in the soil of farms and ranches. And that helps explain why the Biden administration's investing billions of dollars in something called carbon farming. From Oregon Public Broadcasting, Cassandra Profita explains.
Dozens of sheep are grazing on Imperial Stock Ranch in central Oregon.
Look at that family going.
Rancher Gene Carver watches a mama sheep scramble up a hill with two lambs.
These families, they usually have twins.
Carver says these sheep are helping the ranch take carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere and store it in the plants and soil, basically by chomping on fields of grass.
And then, by their regrowth, they're stronger, and we clean the CO2 out of the atmosphere at the same time.
Carver manages the sheep on a planned grazing rotation. It moves them from pasture to pasture often enough to keep the grass growing and moving carbon dioxide from the air into the roots and soil. It's one piece of the ranch's carbon sequestration strategy. Carver and her family have changed the kinds of plants they grow and now avoid tilling up the soil.
Bare ground in general is not a good thing in terms of land health. We wanted to have plants, we wanted to have diversity, and we wanted to have roots in the ground all the time.
All of these changes help to put more carbon in the plants and in the ground, Carver says. But she's not asking anyone to take her word for it. The ranch hired a team of scientists to measure these changes with third-party verification. For Carver, it's a survival strategy in a warming world.
The move toward climate impact measurement is huge. And the reason I'm doing it is because I can see what's coming.
Soil samples across 32,000 acres show Imperial Stock Ranch stored more than a ton of carbon per acre last year. That's enough for Carver to make some extra money. She's selling carbon offsets through a company called Agoro Carbon Alliance. Jerry Stevens is a company sales manager.
They are marketing as a sustainable wool because there's value in that. There's value in organic. There's value in sustainably raised or carbon friendly.
His company has hundreds of contracts for carbon sequestration in agriculture. Stevens says his sales pitch to farmers is less about fighting climate change and more about the healthier soil that comes with carbon farming.
And as a result, companies that have emissions can pay you to store carbon for them.
But for polluters to pay for and claim carbon offsets, scientists say there needs to be a better way to measure exactly how much CO2 is stored by these carbon farms.
How do you prove that you have stored that carbon?
Oregon State University soil scientist Marcus Kleber says experts are still debating how to accurately measure carbon storage across a whole landscape over time. It could take tons of measurements.
It is not as easy as you hope it would be. It's not like, we put the carbon underground.
So putting carbon underground as a measurable climate solution that governments can count on to help save the planet? Kleber says we're not there yet. Still, he says, carbon farming is definitely worth a try. On Imperial Stock Ranch, Carver's hoping one day she can sell both wool and carbon offsets to companies like Ralph Lauren, who can then market carbon-neutral wool clothing.
Why not buy those offsets from the farmers and ranchers who bring the fiber for your product? This is the vision. This is the hope.
It's a vision she's built with a network of 10 ranches, all measuring how much carbon they can store on more than 2 million acres across the West. In Central Oregon, I'm Cassandra Profita for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, in which Fed Chair Jay Powell just needs to get out more. Powell did a quick speech and then a Q&A at Spelman College in Atlanta today, during which he was asked, and this is the actual question, what does fun look like for the chair of the Federal Reserve? Here's what he said. This is his actual answer, too. For me, a big, big party, and I mean, this is as fun as it gets, a really good inflation report. Jay. All right, here's your moment of economic context. Just because we talked about oil a lot this week, the whole OPEC meeting, OPEC Plus, I suppose it was. Crude oil, the U.S. benchmark West Texas Intermediate, $74.07 a barrel, down another 2.5% today. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Donna Tam is the executive editor. Neil Scarborough is the vice president and general manager here at Marketplace World Headquarters. I'm Kai Rizdal. Have a great weekend, everybody. We will see you on Monday, all right? This is APM.
My name is Lee Hawkins. I've been a journalist for over 25 years. On my new podcast, What Happened in Alabama, I get answers to some of the hardest questions about how things came to be for many Black Americans and the truth that must come before any reconciliation can happen. I investigate my family history, my upbringing in Minnesota, and my father's painful nightmares about growing up in Alabama. What Happened in Alabama is a new series confronting the cycles of trauma for myself, my family, and for many Black Americans. Listen now.